Part 2, Chapter 7, Godliness, Part 3. Make every effort to supplement your faith with virtue, and virtue with knowledge, and knowledge with self-control, and self-control with steadfastness, and steadfastness with godliness. So far, we have extensively discussed the sevenfold path, and at last, seen that godliness refers to a new, wondrous, magnetic circuit of the power of the Holy Spirit in the nervous sympathicus, which, in the universal doctrine, is termed the second spinal cord, or the second serpent fire. This second serpent fire is the basis of all new human genesis. On this basis, a new physical form, a new personality, is formed, the aspects and qualities of which we will extensively discuss when the time is ripe. This concerns teachings regarding the apostolic circle, the third temple. Whoever, on the basis of his godliness, is able to enter this third temple, receives all necessary support to be able to learn. 1. How to nourish the new body. 2. How to make the new body grow. 3. How to conduct oneself in it. 4. How to use it. And 5. How, by means of a process, to take leave of the old body of nature. Perhaps this information, in its conciseness, will throw some light on one of the greatest, and for the general public, as yet shrouded, problems of the ancient holy Cathars, namely, their supposed suicide. The records report that the prisoners of the Inquisition during the medieval war against the Cathars, seeing no end to their fate and being subjected to the most sophisticated methods of torture, forcibly left their bodies with a blissful smile on their lips and, by committing suicide, escaped their executioners. Their soulless bodies were found with no sign of external injury and without a trace of poison, in absolute tranquility. What does this mean? You know what suicide is. One dies by one's own hand, forces the death of the body, after which the remainder of the personality proceeds to the reflection sphere. In certain regions of the hereafter, the personality must endure an intensely miserable and sorrowful time until the moment arrives in which death would normally have come. Reincarnation follows immediately afterwards, whereby the forcibly broken thread of life must be picked up again under aggravated circumstances. You will doubtless understand that not a single Cathar ever committed such a deed, which, apart from the further consequences of suicide, would eliminate an existing chance of real liberation from the wheel. No, the holy Cathars possessed the new body, the new personality. They were participants of the apostolic circle of those days and have since that time belonged to the general apostolic brotherhood. From their experiences, we can gain clear insight, which is in complete accord with the lawfulness of the transfigurist processes. For the candidate, by means of the Gnostic serpent fire in the sympathicus, builds up a new personality fully equipped with the building materials of the Gnosis and absolutely free of and unfettered by this nature. It is a personality which develops in a totally different magnetic field of life while still occupying the same space as the dialectical personality. Thus, at a given moment, there are, besides the auric personality, two further personalities in the micros of the candidate, the personality of the old nature and that of the new one. Consequently, there are also two nuclei of consciousness, two I beings in this state. Never make the mistake of thinking that your normal I will be transferred to the new body so that you yourself, as a dialectical center of consciousness, participate in the new life. Your consciousness as a dialectical being belongs to the phenomena of this nature. It will disappear. It will one day cease to exist when you go the path. The other one must increase. You yourself will perish. When the Brotherhood speaks to you, it speaks to you as a microcosmic totality. It speaks to you and to the other one who, if you still do not possess it in the form of a personality, is still potentially present in you in your micros, hidden as seed. You can understand that it is of the greatest importance for the servants of the serving brotherhood in our field of existence who already possess the new being to maintain the old dialectical personality as long as possible, for through this dialectical personality, contact can be made with dialectical people. Unobtrusively and in a normal, natural manner, people can be fished from the sea of life of the fallen world. Therefore, they will to this end maintain their dialectical personality to the uttermost limits of what is practically attainable. Only when their time has come do they leave, without any ostentation, their old natural form. They die, but you will understand that this death is something quite different from that of any other person. This death is not the fruit of sin, no splitting of the personality whereby the remains move to the hereafter, but rather with this death the grave is found completely empty. Only the cloak of the old nature remains. It is not a body that is abandoned, for this body was a disguise for many years, a cloak, a veil of another reality. Normally, when somebody dies, the remains of the personality are still present after the death of the body, but with the transfigurist initiate, the remains of the personality had long disappeared. They had long since died in Jesus the Lord, as the old brotherhood of the Rosicrucians called it. What remained was just a disguise, the outward appearance of the old form of the body which was being used in the service of mankind for as long as possible. When, at a given moment, this old garment is thrown off, it becomes apparent that nothing, absolutely nothing, remains of the old existence any longer, neither here nor in the hereafter. This is why it is also said that the grave of Jesus the Lord was found completely empty. One saw nothing but a rolled-up shroud, namely, the outer garment of the old form of the bodily figure. When Mary Magdalene wishes to see the Lord, she has to look backwards. This looking backwards is an ancient Gnostic expression for gazing into the original magnetic space, now new for her once more. There she sees him whom she has always known in her innermost, but whom she cannot approach as she still exists in the old state of ordinary nature. Therefore she is told, "Don't touch me." Here the same law is intended that caused Ananias and Sapphira to die. One cannot approach the entirely different with what is dialectical without causing a catastrophe. If, in the light of above, you now reflect on the ancient Cathars, you will understand. A group of prisoners was walled in alive in a cave. A wall several feet thick lay between them and the outside world. The intention is clear, a slow death by starvation, not a single chance of liberation. Do you think they would suffer for days, perhaps weeks, and then die in darkness and filth? No, for they who had long since made the sympathetic nervous system cerebrospinal, they knew. Now our time has come, now our task is fulfilled. And with one small twist of the will to the nervous vagus, they left the garment of their camouflage to meet eternal freedom, leaving the grave behind them, empty. Another group of them, on top of the mountain of the cross at Foix, was fettered and thrown down into a ravine. Do you think they awaited the result of their fall? Contused, bleeding from terrible wounds, with broken limbs, dying under hellish pains. No, before they reached the ground, they had left the garments of their camouflage and were winging their upway towards the clarity of the new life. So it was, too, for those who went to the stake, for those who were cast into dungeons. As they no longer belonged to this world when the sacrilegious hand of dialectical violence reached out to them, they entered into their own fatherland. This is the truth of the death of Jesus. This is the truth of the supposed suicide of the ancient Cathars. Those who do not know and cannot see cast their hands before their faces in despair, saying, "Oh, how terrible! what immeasurable suffering, but all those do know sing a hymn, a song of effervescent joy, for those who, while living, die the voluntary death of nature in the endurer, can no longer be harmed by the second death, the death of the camouflage body. If you understand all this, then pay attention to the Sermon on the Mount for your further information. To the pupils of the Apostolic Brotherhood, who possess the other one, it is said, "You have heard it said, an eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist evil. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone would sue you and take your coat, let him have your cloak as well." What the hordes of the Inquisition meant to achieve in the war against the Albigensians was the destruction of the garment of the outward appearance of the holy Cathars, for they departed from the mystification that beneath this cloak the living heart of the Gnosis was beating. But with a laugh that resounded through the mountains, the Cathars left their enemies the dialectical cloak after having fulfilled their task for as long as possible and went up into the serene heights of the sacred stillness. They ascended from tear-filled surroundings to a new morning. They were already brothers and sisters of the dawn. They possessed the bodies for it, but they remained for as long as possible in the regions of the night in order to help the seekers in their darkness. But do you think they would fight for that? They entered into the new life because they knew that there would always be helpers, brothers and sisters. The chain of the serving brotherhood on earth will never be severed. Is there somebody who wants to take the coat of one of them? He will leave his assailants his cloak as well. He will not provoke them saying, "Please hurry up," for he knows his duty. But, spontaneously and naturally, he longs for the moment of departure. And when the time of farewell comes, his place is immediately taken by a successor. Do you think this point of view is wrong? Then heed what Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5. "For we know that if the earthly tent we live in is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heaven. Here indeed we groan and long to put on our heavenly dwelling. For while we are still in this tent, we only have one purpose, that we may not be found unclothed, and that what is mortal may be swallowed up by life. It is the Gnosis which has prepared us for this, and which has given us godliness as building material. And so we turn to all who stand on the fifth step, and to those who long for this state of Freemasonry, for this profession of building. These holy values of the new life have been carried closer than ever to you. The values of the Consolamentum, which on the fifth step, that of godliness, become a fact in the Sympathicus, are being spelled out to you word for word, and you, therefore, can also absorb the words of Ephesians 2 as if they were spoken to you. So then you are no longer strangers and sojourners, but you are fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of the Gnosis, built upon the foundation of the Apostolic Brotherhood, Christ himself being the cornerstone, in whom the whole structure is joined together and grows into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you also are built into it for a dwelling place of God in the Spirit. Free of all dialectical nature, an unshakable edifice can be erected on the basis of a new magnetic circle. This office of construction is your vocation. Whoever can demonstrate his tools will, in the apostolic circle, receive the opportunity to build this new temple, holy in the Lord, neatly fitting a new abode. Whoever enters into this heaven is safe, immune to all violence. Whoever dwells in this heaven will laugh for the first time in his microcosmic fallen existence, laugh redeemingly, jubilating for joy.